Our main speaker tonight is Paul.
No more groupies, Peggy. I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. My name's Paul E. Wow. What are we laughing at now? The look? The attitude? I mean, you know, speaking of which, by the way, thanks. I mean, that was great. Adam and Sandy, we had a lot in common. No, I'm serious. When I got sober in Florida, they told me if you couldn't put in the basket, take out. Until I went to all those meetings, there was nothing left in the basket. So that was number one. Sandy, I also was a wine drinker, but I started with Thunderbird wine. Anyway, if you're new or you're coming back, welcome home. You're off the hook, and all of those newcomers, that's spectacular. It's wonderful. You're in for the ride of your life. Fasten your seatbelt, and, you know, they really promote sponsorship here. And I'm not a member of this group, but I really promote sponsorship because without a sponsor, without getting that guy to guide me, I wouldn't be here anymore. I know that today. In case you have a hearing problem, I'm from New York. I just got the look of speak into the mic. Okay. I'm from Bayside, Queens, and I'm a product of the 60s. Tune in, turn on, and drop out. And I had so much potential. I don't know what happened. Well, I do know what happened, actually. I guess to sum it up, because I really do want to talk about this journey, which is so incredible, and as Sandy spoke about God, because that's really what it's about. But in 1965, the Beatles came to Shea Stadium, and I went there. And for all intents and purposes, I woke up 15 years later. Now, that's my story in a general way. As it says in our informational pamphlet, I'm not going to fill you in with all the gory details, maybe just one or two. Being that, by the way, the convention, I heard so many people said it was so wonderful. My sponsor was there and his sponsor was there. I've been to one. I was at the 50th International Convention in Montreal in 1985. And about 40 of us went from Florida. But lest I digress, you know, I don't come from an alcoholic family. I just don't. Originally, when I got sober, I went into my first meeting, and it seemed that everybody that stood up at the podium said, I'm an Irish Catholic from Boston. My grandmother, grandfather, cousins, anybody I ever met, my parakeet was an alcoholic. And I'm sitting in this 101 club in Pompano Beach, Florida, and I'm a Jewish alcoholic heroin addict from New York City, and I don't think I belong in Alcoholics Anonymous. Then it seemed to me, and this was 1980 when I got sober, and it seemed to me that everybody that went to the podium said the following. I came to AA in 1952. I stayed for 4 years. I went out for 3. I came back for 5. I stayed for 6, I went out for 7, and now I have 1 year sobriety. So I thought, like, you came here as a warm-up, and then, you know, you went out for some more getting beat up, and then you came back, and then things got good, because they do, and then you went out for some more. Let me tell you something. You don't need to do that. By God's grace, an incredible, inhuman desperation and degradation and humiliation and terrible things to family members and anybody I ever met, I got here right on time, and I have never had to leave, no matter what. And that's what was told to me from day one. You know, just one quick story from when I was out there. I mean, really, you know, there's no point. If you're here, you did whatever you had to do. You don't have to do any more. I promise you this. If you go out there after being sober a while, it's going to get worse. And if you've been sober a long while and you go out there, it's going to get a lot worse, because that's what's known as the progressive nature of this disease. Beginning and end of story. Okay, if you're here, don't leave. Because the other end of that is you may not make it back. You know, and that happens all the time. So anyway, so in the 60s, I mean, I played the handout. Two or three arrests. I got into, you know, dry goods or whatever they call it. Drugs. You're not allowed to talk about it. But, no, but Peggy always looks at it. What happens is they ask me to speak here every few years, because the people that asked me last time, they're not here anymore, so then they forget. So then the new people ask me. But the bottom line is, Peggy, get over it. I love you. You know that. The bottom line is, man, is if you're here, you're off the hook. And if you're here, I don't care how you got here, because the solution is how to stay. As a matter of fact, you know, there are 100 12-step programs, okay? I mean, everything, and I qualify for every one of them, except one. No, because we have step meetings in Florida where you lead the steps for 3 months, and I've been privileged to do that. And the one group that's actually here in New York City that I don't qualify for, it's listed, there are meetings, and it's called Lip Balm Anonymous. Honest to God, look it up. Google it when you go home. There's a whole... Now, I could just imagine if my bottom was lip balm, going with an overcoat to the Eckers, the CVS. Oh, my. Different flavors. Now, I certainly hope there's no lip balm members here, but, I mean, I swear to God, it's meaningless. I kid you not. So, anyway, I managed to destroy my life in New York City, okay? All of my family's life and the whole, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and like that song by Jackson Browne, in 65 I was 17, in 69 I was 21. That's my age, running on empty. Okay? And by the time I got here, I was beyond empty. I'll tell one story that happened right here in Manhattan, and then I'll talk about the miracle of sobriety. And the story that happened after incredible humiliation in the 60s, in the 70s. Now, I was a functional alcoholic. I was making money. I was a businessman. I was a national sales manager of a home improvement company in Flushing, New York, and I was doing very well. So I decided, it was 1976, to invite my relatives, my cousin from Baltimore, Maryland, to come up to New York. My daughter at that time, well, she's 41 now, so she was 2. And I invited them to come up simply so I could take them to a Broadway show so they would see how well I was doing, so they could say to the family that was only always hearing stuff, did you hear what Paul did last week? Did you hear what happened to Paul? Did you hear he went through the windshield on the Long Island Expressway? Did you hear he ended up in jail at the Newport Jazz Fest? I mean, you know, all of those things. So I invite my cousin Mark and Arlene up to go see the leading show on Broadway on February 1st, 1976, and the show was Equus with Anthony Perkins. Now, it was playing at the Helen Hayes Theater, and so I invite Mark and Arlene. They come to my apartment in Bayside, beautiful apartment, and I take them, and they see my daughter in the bedroom, in the crib, and I take them in my luxury car to Rossoff's Steakhouse, right around the corner from the show. We have a sumptuous dinner, and I figure they're already saying to themselves, and there weren't cell phones back then, but if there were, they might have called my Uncle Mush and said, you're not going to believe it. He is incredible. I mean, it's amazing. Drive a Lincoln Continental, but however, in another few hours, the call would have been a little different. Here's what happened. It was Saturday, February 1st, 1976. I had gotten from a scalper second row center seats to the show Equus with Anthony Perkins, which I'm sure was a great show. I can't really... But here's what happened, without belaboring the point. I remember him. He's a psychiatrist, and he's sitting on the stage. There's a horse on the stage, and he's talking to the audience as if they're his patients. And it's a very somber play. I mean, look, I, 40 years later, have no idea what it was about. But what I'm going to tell you is this. At some point in this play, Anthony Perkins asked a question of the audience. Now, the other 1,800 people knew it's what was known as a rhetorical question. However, I had not gotten that memo. I stood up, second row center, Broadway, Helen Hayes Theater, 1976. Anthony Perkins was no further than the second row. And he asked this question, the place is totally silent. And I said, that's because my name is Paul Efron. Let me tell you what happened from that moment for the next 12 months. Well, first of all, and this is like in the movies as told to, you know, this is like I don't remember anything from this point forward. But my wife and my cousin Mark were looking behind me. What just happened? Like, they knew I wasn't an understudy for this show. They also knew, but I'm not too certain at this point, and the more I've tried to reflect on that night, I fully believe that half of the people in that theater might have thought I was in the show. No, it was a moronic, making no sense show. It would have made as much sense, moron jumps up from second row, screams at the star. So anyway, they pulled me down. I did it again 10 minutes later. We were asked to leave the theater. Anytime it's been on TV or played in a show, for some reason, even if I have the best of intention to see it, I've never been able to see it. So it's probably something that maybe right before I check out, I will get to see. Maybe not. I don't know. But what happened is we went home that night. I threw them out of my apartment in the middle of the night. I made them drive back to Maryland. And the next morning, I woke up in one of New York City's, before they were treatment centers, they were called mental hospitals, asylums, loony bins. Like my friend Gatsby used to say, houses for the very, very nervous. And that's where I went. That's where my alcoholism and addiction took me. It took me lower and lower. And I started off at the real nice ones, Hillside General Hospital. They used to say, they advertised in the Sunday Times, let your families come and watch you make leather belts over the weekend and stroll our lovely grounds. And by the end of the 1 year, with many diagnoses, I became suicidal from this happy-go-lucky drunk, from this guy that never had a problem. No matter how bad my alcoholism or addiction was, I never, like, really cared. It was no big deal. Okay, let's go. Well, I attempted suicide. I ended up in a coma for 6.5 days. It was not a cry for help. It was stop the world, I want to get off. On the third day of that coma, the doctors at Long Island Jewish Hospital called my parents and my wife into the consultation room and said the following. Don't waste your time for the 10 minutes you're allowed to visit every 2 hours in intensive care, because if he happens to make it, he's going to be a vegetable. By God's grace, there was something for me to do. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here. Otherwise, none of us would be here. So my parents kept coming. My wife kept coming. 3.5 days after that diagnosis, I came out of that coma. Was I finished? No, that was 1977. I had another 3 years of hell, misery, and degradation on the streets of New York City. When my wife, Sharon, had enough, after 5 arrests, maybe 6, 2 comas, 5 or 6 mental hospitals, my last residence in New York State was a place that my parents used to point to when I was a kid. That's my lucky number, 15. Well, we'll be good then. Because we'll be amazed before we are halfway through. So, you used to go to the beach when you're from Queens. Your parents would drive you, and they would point to this imposing structure off of the Grand Central Parkway. And they said, if you don't straighten up, you're going to end up there. Well, I did. That was my last residence in New York State, was Creedmoor State Hospital, a hellhole of inhuman proportions. As a matter of fact, I was there when Geraldo Rivera was doing the expose on Willowbrook State Hospital. I was in Creedmoor State Hospital. And it was just, like, not even believable. I'm not going to bore you with the gory details. The only thing I can tell you, if you keep drinking and using, you're going to end up there. Or worse, because that's what happens. That's what happens. By God's grace, I got out of there. I don't know how. But I accepted that. I mean, my life had become a rocking chair watching a television that didn't work. And I was okay with it. I got thrown out of New York, and I went to Florida. And that's when this miracle began for me. I was just bouncing around Florida. By this time, I was on government disability insurance because I had flipped out. And the United States government determined I was never going to work again. And they were sending me checks every month to not work. In 1980, I was getting $1,407 a month tax-free from the United States government. So when I finally got to this program, I was a paid member of Alcoholics Anonymous. All I had to do was go to the mailbox on the third of the month, man, I was in good shape. So here's what happened. I'm reading the Miami Herald in February of 1980, and there's an article, the front page of one of the sections, about a brand new program that had just started in Fort Lauderdale, borrowed from Alcoholics Anonymous, called Narcotics Anonymous. It was one meeting. One meeting in all of Fort Lauderdale. There were no meetings in New York City. I made a phone call. Some guy came and picked me up. There were 6 people in this place, St. Francis Mission, in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And it was a really dark, dank room with these steps on the wall. And I went up to the guy that took me, and I said, you know what? This is just another place I don't belong. And I said, thanks, but no thanks. I'll get home on my own. I have some money. This was the first, I mean, looking back, obviously, in the coma, and so many other times, I know that God was carrying me. But looking back at this one moment in my life, when they talk about seconds and inches, which I really believe life is all about, but for 1 second or but for 1 inch, it all would have been missed. And here's what happened. At or about 8:28 p.m. on February 12th, 1980, as I had said thank you to the guy who took me to the meeting and was leaving, in walked a guy from my block in Queens, New York City. Mark Friedman, God rest his soul, he died last year, sober, from pancreatic cancer. But we did this whole thing together, okay? So we hugged at the door. I'm walking out. He's walking in. I go and get a cup of coffee. I look up at the front of the room. He was the speaker that night. He had been asked to speak prior to that night, and here it was, and I didn't need to listen to his story. I lived it with him. But when he sat, his arrests were in the paper just like mine. He sat in the front of that room. He said, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink or a drug for 6 months. That got my attention. Because I know Mark, just like myself, couldn't go 6 weeks. He couldn't go 6 days. As a matter of fact, the only time either of us ever refused a drink or a drug is if we misunderstood the question. I mean, you know, I refuse a drink or a drug is if I'm unconscious, then I've had enough. Otherwise, leave me alone. Let's keep the party started. So anyway, back then, before chips and all of this other thing, we had little poker chips. and it was a white chip. And I don't know what it means to this day. I know all the cute sayings, but you know what? Something happened that night. Because 2 days later, on February 14th, 1980, and both my parents have passed since I've been sober. They both saw me sober. But 2 days later, I wrote a two-page letter to my parents, and I now have it. And I said, look, I'm not making any promises, but I think something might have happened, and I may not take a drink or a drug again. And I haven't. Does that mean it's been all clear? Absolutely not, man. This is what life is about. Getting beat up. I was laughing with the girl with the thing. She reminded me of the ring girl at the World Series of, you know, like at one of the fights in Vegas, you know, like doing the luncheon thing. And that's what happens. If you get sober, you're going to get knocked out. You're going to get knocked down like the Frank Sinatra song, just get back up. That's what it is. You don't come in here, skip up the 12 golden steps of life and never experience a negative emotion. What this is about is you come in here, you get beat up, you don't pick up, you share with a sponsor, you get out of yourself, you help someone else, and your life gets better. That's really the beginning and end of the story. You know, I am about, like, I guess it was Lou Gehrig that said at Yankee Stadium when he was, you know, he had ALS, which is Lou Gehrig's disease. No, and he was, like, dying, and he was getting an award at Yankee Stadium, and he said, you know, I'm the luckiest guy in the world. He said, because he's a New York Yankee, I'm the luckiest guy in the world because I found you people. And because of you people, I found a God that loves me to pieces. Okay, I have two great kids, like Sandy was talking about. I'm going to become a grandfather in September. Think about this, that I could have missed this whole freaking thing if I died in 1976 or in 1969 or in any of the years when I was there on the streets. By the grace of God, I've been given a purpose. My purpose? To stay sober, try to help the next bozo on the bus. Beginning and end of the story, okay? I've found love in these rooms that's not even believable. I've had a sponsor the entire time I've been sober. I'm going to tell you about Fred T. He told me, he says, Paul, if you want what I have, you call me every day. Call me at 5:30. I didn't even have a phone, by the way. I called not from a payphone in Fort Lauderdale. And I said, all right, Fred. He says, where did you go? Where are you going? Every day from 5:30, so now I'm sober a year and a half, and my life's getting better. If you're sober a year and a half, your life is getting better. Now I'm living on the intercoastal. I'm driving a Z car. I'm not off disability yet, but I'm still getting close. They never told me don't drink, don't drug, and go to work. They just said don't drink, don't drug, and go to meetings. They left that other piece out. So my life's getting better, and one day I wake up and I go to Fred at the 101. I said, hey, Fred, I'm a little upset. He says, about what? I said, you know, I've called you every day for a year and a half. You haven't called me once. This is what happened. Fred, God rest his soul, he had these little horn-rimmed glasses on, and he took them off, and he looked at me without missing a beat, and he says, you know what, Paul? As soon as you have something I want, I'll be sure to give you a call. And he turned and walked away. Now, if I did that today to someone, they call up Inner Group. You know what my sponsor did? What about my inner child? I can't believe it. Oh, my God. Shoot your inner child, for Christ's sake. Anyway, so Fred told me continually to be grateful that I had the gift of desperation. I had it when I got here on February 12th, 1980. I have it today. I got here 2 months before my 32nd birthday. I was 67 in April. That's not humanly possible. No, it really isn't. It's just not humanly possible, which means that it must be inhumanly possible, which means that some power much greater than myself that I choose to call God saw fit to rescue me from my abyss. Saw way back then, saw something that somewhere I could possibly be of service. And that's what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not a selfish program. It's a selfless program. I woke up this morning, the first thing I was thinking about was a couple of guys I'm sponsoring that are having trouble. I can't live on what I did yesterday. I can't live on the fact that I was at the Montreal Convention in 1985. I got to suit up and show up every day and stay content. Five-time loser. Good girl. 5 minutes. Now we're going to have to rush it up. We're going to do the speed end. So anyway, so I'm up here. You know, I've been traveling up and back since I got sober. And I'm married to a beautiful woman. Again, third time being a charm, obviously. She's not here, but I think she would even agree. So I'm up and I'm speaking at a Thanksgiving event or dinner on Clintonville Street at the Queens Group, some North Queens group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they had me speak, and I don't ever say the same thing, ever. So I happen to mention the gift of desperation. We take a break after the talk. Some guy after the meeting, he's raising his hand. I mean, after the break, and he says, you're not going to believe it, the gift of desperation. That was my home group in Long Island 10 years ago. He says, and you know that's G-O-D. I see the silence. But I was not as silent as you. I went, of course. Yeah. I didn't have a clue. So I'm sitting here in the front of the room with these people with 9,000 years of sobriety. And I'm saying, like always in my life, you knew it? Of course I knew it. I wrote it. What, are you kidding me? So I'm shaking my head. And then before the end of the meeting, I knew I couldn't leave the meeting. I raised my hand and I said, listen, truth be told, I never knew. For the 20-something years that Fred was telling me, that gift of desperation was G-O-D. I always heard good orderly direction, group of drunks, ba-ba-ba-ba-ba, all of that other stuff. So what happened is after the meeting, now Fred was already had already passed. He's gone 10 years. I called everyone I sponsored in Fort Lauderdale. I called people up here. No one knew it was G-O-D. No one knew it was God. So the only way that I'm going to find out, and I'm not in any rush today, but is when I go to wherever I go, because I don't even know if Fred knew it was G-O-D. I'm going to have to ask him if that was God that he was talking about, that gift of desperation. Now, I'm going to tell you, I love God's stories, and there's so many of them, there's too many to count. But the most recent is the best, and this just happened. Driving in from East Hampton, a friend of mine was driving, and we were talking, and a very good friend of mine, I know my whole sobriety, and we're talking, and all of a sudden the phone rings, and it's from Israel. And I sponsor a guy who did his aliyah and moved to Israel. He has 32 years, and he lives in Tzfat, and he's very active in the program in Tzfat. Another guy who I sponsor in Florida has been having a very, very, very difficult time after having had 7 years, went out, and now can't put any time together. Okay, and he's inches away from whatever, but it's not going to be pretty. So one thing leads to another. My friend in Israel, who used to be called Stefan, and his name is now Shmuel, he changed it, he did the whole full Monty. And we arranged that Steve went over there on Saturday. They're there now. He didn't buy a return ticket. So Shmuel, Stephen from Florida, who's been having a difficult time, is staying with Shmuel in Tzfat. And they called as we're getting on the Triborough Bridge. And as 1 minute, quick. As we're getting on the Triborough Bridge, I look to the right, it starts raining. It's raining. And I say, so they're telling me what's happening there and how Steve's really starting to get into it. And they went to this great meeting last night and everybody's embracing him, et cetera, et cetera. And the rain's coming. And I say, well, it looks nice to the left and it's dark to the right. And as God is my witness, not my judge, I said right then and there, Margie and Alan heard this. They were sitting there. And I said, You know, it's so great that you called. I'm on my way into the city right now. And I'll tell you what, this sun shower that we're getting right now, I wouldn't be surprised if I saw a rainbow in the next minute. As I'm standing here at 5:30 p.m., or whatever time I got here, driving over the Triborough Bridge, we looked to the right. We didn't see it. And then all of a sudden, the entire sky was a rainbow. Let me tell you something. God is not finished with us yet. Say thank you tonight, no matter what happened, and tomorrow will be another day. Thanks for listening.